is seldom measured, even in 100,000 years of us. Now we can see it here, we can remember and accept it. I vow to declare this truth along with my son.
This is the Buddha. This is the Dharma. This is the Sangha. I'd like to be a little more detailed today in explanation of how the will needs to be used in this process of the cleansing and conversion of karma. Remind you again of the peculiar catch-22 that someone doing this, undergoing this process, encounters. That is, in order to deal with self, self has to come up in its most distilled and difficult aspects. So you want to deal with it, and it seems to be made all the more difficult to deal with it by undergoing the process and doing the training that deals with it. Well, there's no getting around this except by creating a kind of wall or perpetuating a kind of wall between us and our deeper karmic inheritance. One pays a price for such a wall. Having such a wall, one may go through one's whole life without knowing the depth of anguish that someone knows who takes down that wall. At the same time, as Dogen said, one leaves oneself much more vulnerable to changeableness. Because the essential problems of ignorance and clinging are not being dealt with. And if one doesn't know the abysmal depths that one has to encounter, one doesn't know the magnificent heights either. The Master so often said, this is not a practice that brings happiness. The dog in the sun is happy. Shortly before her death, she told me when we were alone together, Koshin, we don't need happiness, we know ecstasy. By which he meant a lot more than just a state of feeling. It's a good thing we don't need it, the happiness, because there ain't much in it for someone who does this deeply. And it doesn't mean you're unhappy either. There is something deeper than passing states of feeling and thought. The pivot point for the whole of the spiritual life is pure meditation. If you look at those rules for meditation that we recite so frequently, and you apply those, what's being described there, to even the darkest and most difficult things that you go through in the spiritual life, you see right in those rules for meditation how it is to be dealt with. One has to draw upon that infinitely deep, infinitely wise, infinitely compassionate well of stillness within oneself. One has to draw upon the Buddha nature in order to do this. And the meaning, the spiritual meaning of those words that describe how to meditate is that this is taking refuge in our own Buddha nature. Without taking refuge in that well of stillness and positivity within ourselves, and it's within everyone, no matter how much it may be buried under muck, it's there. Without taking refuge in that, we are inevitably going to be severely battered about by the storms on the surface. And if you're doing a practice that makes those storms even worse at times, because it's actually bringing up the razor edge, and the painful razor edge of greed, hate, and delusion, well, you've got to have something to rely on to help you there. People talk about letting go. But, you know, none of us is in the end going to let go unless we have something else we can hang on to. And that's the truth of the matter. You have to hang on to meditation. And by that means hang on to the Buddha nature, to the eternal, for dear life at times in this process. Reverend Master wrote in 1976, "Whether I am brightly alive or dying, hold fast to the Lord of the house." And that's when she was doing exactly that for dear life. For the sake of her spiritual life, which is far more than our physical life. The opposites within which we get buffeted about, the opposites of fascination and horror, of attraction and repulsion, of grief and giddiness, all these opposites, which are easy to describe in terms of words and concepts, easy to represent in that way. But when they're hitting you with their full force in feeling, it's another matter. You know, reason goes right out the window. And you're sitting there and all of a sudden you're seeing someone you normally trust and love, and you know you normally trust and love, as a demon. Or seeing yourself in this way. Or you're seeing another person who normally you wouldn't even notice as an angel that's going to save you. You're unaccountably furious or unaccountably miserable with dark, despairing grief, or unaccountably terrified. Or unaccountably, incredibly confused. That's when the deeper aspects of the karma are welling up towards the surface. That's when you really need to take refuge in that meditation. I've often told the story how in 1976, when Reverend Master was down in her retreat, and the whole community was undergoing a very intense ripening period, how every time I'd sit in meditation, it'd be like I'd be anywhere but on that cushion in my mind. I'd get up from that cushion, I'd shake my head, and I'd think, that was a half hour, 40 minute meditation period, and I haven't been here for 2 seconds of it. And I remember, and again, I don't know where I got this from, but somehow I knew, leave it there. Leave it there. Don't draw any conclusions. Don't make any judgments. Don't fret about it. Trust the meditation, even if your mind's all over the place. Trust what you're doing there. Trust it. I remember telling myself again and again, deciding again and again, making a conscious choice when I got up from that cushion and stood up in front of the tan where the monks sit, the raised platform where the monks sit, before leaving the meditation hall. I remember just choosing to leave it all there and try it again next time. Well, when Reverend Master got back a few months later from a retreat, and all kinds of stuff started popping loose for, you know, all of us in the community, I found out why I'd been under such inner agitation. Things started to come up for me that were deeply buried and deeply frightening to me. And then the solution was the same. Sit still, and when something says run for help, then run for help. But keep your spiritual grounding. In daily life, because we can't be sitting in formal meditation all the time. You know, in daily life, the way to go about this is to just keep one's focus, the focus of our concentration, focus of our attention on just the next thing that needs to be done. We find ourselves running ahead, come back to the present. When we find ourselves fretting over the past, even the very recent past, come back to the present. The more we dwell on the past and the future, the more we agitate ourselves and upset ourselves. And the more we stir that stuff up that's trying to distill down and settle out and concentrate itself naturally within us to the point where it can undergo the essentials conversion. It's like making maple syrup, you know, you get a vast amount of water out of the maple trees. It's kind of sweet. And then they cook it down and cook it down and cook it down until you get this wonderful sweet syrup. It takes ages to cook it down. One has to patiently undergo that cooking process. Here again, you know, the precepts really come into play. Even if negative thoughts happen to be in some respect true, it still isn't spiritually healthy and helpful to dwell upon them. A wonderful phrase that Reverend Master came up for, Reverend Master, un-Buddhist even if true. We start the breakage of the precepts, we start to wander from the mind of meditation in our thoughts. And it's amazing when the karma is really active in us and that cooking process is going hot and heavy. It's amazing how, with what lightning speed, the thoughts can go from a mere suspicion of something to full-blown paranoia or rage. Or a delusional conviction. You know, it would be so nice if I could sit here and say, oh, well now, you do this year after year after year and everything just, you know, steadily brightens and the load steadily lightens and you gradually get happier and happier and more serene. And there, you know, there's an element of truth in that. But it's a much bumpier ride than that. Much, much. And it's often not till many years into training that some of the very deepest, darkest stuff can finally get to the surface to get some help. Because it would have been overwhelming to come up too early. So people have been training decades, all of a sudden find themselves pitched into hell. That's progress. But it sure as hell doesn't feel like progress. In The Dark Night of the Soul, St. John of the Cross talked a lot about this process. Again, it's not unique to Buddhism. This happens within any contemplative tradition. And he distinguished between what he called the dark night of sense, which happens earlier in training, and the dark night of the soul, which happens later. Which I think is equivalent, really, to like the first and third kensho's, basically. The process that leads up to the first and third kensho's. And no one simply can't imagine the firestorm of pain that hits in that third one. It needs a lot of preparation. A lot of preparation. And one needs all the help one can get at the time. Not just from God, but from man. Help of the right kind, from the right person or people. But that's all provided by the Eternal. When Dogen was transmitted, he asked some questions of his master. I won't say what those questions were. His master's response was something along the lines of, well, maybe, but study in detail. Do not think it is easy. Study in detail. Do not think it is easy. Our practice is study in detail, not intellectual study, meditational, contemplative, studious practice, you might say. So, to continue the theme from yesterday's talk, the essential thing in the grasping of the will is to keep that mind in meditation. The mind in meditation is the mind that walks the middle path, the path that transcends the extremes. One must be gentle and patient. And one must not be so gentle and so patient that one simply never makes a move when it's time to make a move. And one can't say no when it's time to say no. One must say no when it is time to say no. And it will not help to say no in a way that is harsh. I'm speaking here of saying no to ourselves. There's the aspects of ourselves that are getting too kicky. And when that wave of anger or paranoia hits, you can say, actually, no, this time I'm not going with you. And sit through that wave of feeling. It'll pass. Or that wave of confused and deluded thought, it will pass. That is a compassionate no, not a harsh, punitive no. A harsh and punitive no will only make the inner desperation all the more desperate. Similarly, with fascination and horror. If one gets fascinated with or by the memories and feelings and peculiar kinds of experiences that happen to the body and in the mind, if one gets fascinated by them and grasps after them, it's really the old pulling the tiger by the tail thing. Eventually, one's going to be pulling so much that tiger is going to end up in one's lap. And then one will swing to the other extreme of horror. Some of us will recall all too vividly how this happened to a member of our community a couple years ago. First the fascination, then the horror. Don't go down the fascination road. And when the horror hits, sit still. It's just shadows. It's just shadows. It's all just shadows. What's real is the eternal. Hold fast to the eternal. Sit still within and underneath that flow of feeling and thought. Don't give shadows from the past a reality that they do not have in themselves. Don't give reflections in the mirror the reality that only the mirror has. It's hard enough to deal with some of these things knowing they're shadows. It's really hard thinking that they're realities. They're not.
not touch to all the Buddha.